Okay, so this week you guys have really outdone yourselves, sending in this this whole ebook on confined space entry.
Yeah, looks like someone really wanted a deep dive on this one.
It's a hefty one for sure, and it dives deep into like all the safety protocols and procedures, the absolute gold standard. But honestly, who has time to read through all of this? So today we're going to break it down. We'll pull out the most critical information, the need-to-know stuff about confined spaces.
Absolutely. We want to give you the tools to really understand these spaces and, the most important thing, how to keep everyone safe when working in them.
Right, without getting bogged down in all the technical jargon.
Exactly. Consider this your crash course on confined space safety.
Okay, so first things first, let's define what we're actually talking about here. What are the key characteristics that make a space confined?
Well, the ebook lays out three main criteria. First off, it needs to be big enough for a person to actually enter and work inside, not just like a tiny crawl space.
Right, but it doesn't need to be a giant warehouse either.
Exactly. Just large enough for someone to at least partially get in and do a job. Second, there needs to be a limited or restricted entry and exit. We're talking things like ladders, hatches, narrow doorways, you know, anything that makes getting in and out a bit tricky.
Yeah, definitely not your average walk-in closet.
And third, it can't be designed for continuous occupancy. These spaces aren't meant for people to be hanging out in for extended periods.
Not your typical office space, then.
Definitely not. It's more about spaces designed for specific tasks that are, you know, temporary. Now, when we think of confined spaces, we often picture like huge industrial settings.
Yeah, factories, plants, that kind of thing.
But this guide really highlights how these spaces can pop up pretty much anywhere.
So give us some examples. Where might we encounter these unexpected confined spaces?
Well, think about storage tanks in the oil and gas industry.
Oh, right, for storing fuel or chemicals.
Exactly. Workers might need to go in there for cleaning, inspections, repairs. But that introduces risks like toxic fumes or even, you know, the danger of being engulfed by the contents if something goes wrong.
Engulfment? I mean, that's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah, it's a very real hazard. And the ebook goes into some detail about the dangers and precautions. Then you've got silos in agriculture, those giant structures for storing grain or animal feed.
Okay, so what's the risk there?
Engulfment, again, is a huge concern with silos. I mean, imagine being surrounded by tons of loose grain. It can happen so fast, and it's incredibly difficult to escape once you're trapped. Plus, there's the risk of hazardous gases from the fermentation process.
That's a sobering thought for sure.
Moving on to utilities and sewage, you've got manholes, those access points in the ground.
Yeah, we see those everywhere.
But they're prime examples of confined spaces. People working in those are dealing with potential toxic gases, low oxygen levels, and just the general difficulty of working in such a cramped environment.
Right. It's not just the space itself. It's the conditions inside that can be dangerous.
Exactly. Pipelines, too, whether they're for water, oil, or gas, can become confined spaces when they need maintenance or repairs.
I guess you'd have similar risks there.
Yeah, you're dealing with the potential for flooding, those same toxic atmospheres, and it can be incredibly physically demanding to work in such tight spaces.
So we've got storage tanks, silos, manholes, pipelines. Any other unexpected places we might find these confined spaces?
Well, let's not forget about tunnels and construction or mining. I mean, those are classic examples of confined spaces with all the risks that come with them.
Like what specifically?
Well, you've got the danger of collapses, poor ventilation, and of course the difficulty of getting out quickly if something does go wrong.
Right, and the further you go in, the harder it is to get back out.
Exactly. And then there are sewers, which are probably the least glamorous but equally important confined spaces to consider.
So even the most basic infrastructure involves these spaces and the potential risks.
Absolutely. You've got the potential for harmful gases, bacteria, slippery surfaces. It's a whole different set of challenges.
So it's clear that not all confined spaces are created equal in terms of their inherent danger. The ebook talks about permit required versus non-permit required spaces. What's the key difference there?
This is a crucial distinction, and it all comes down to the level of risk involved. Permit-required confined spaces, they're the ones that have a high potential for serious hazards.
So things that could cause, like, really serious harm or even death?
Exactly. It could be a hazardous atmosphere, like toxic gases, flammable vapors. It could be a risk of engulfment, you know, like we talked about with silos. Or there could be a chance of someone getting trapped, asphyxiated, or just facing any other serious safety or health threat. Entering these spaces absolutely requires a permit, no exceptions.
And this permit, what's its purpose?
The permit acts like a safety checklist. It ensures that all the necessary precautions are taken before anyone sets foot in the space. It's all about minimizing the risk as much as possible.
It's like a gatekeeper for the high-risk zones. So what about non-permit required spaces?
Well, these are spaces that don't have the potential for those really serious atmospheric hazards that could cause, you know, irreversible harm.
So they're still confined spaces, but the level of risk is lower.
Exactly. A good example might be a large storage room with just one entrance. It technically fits the definition, but there's no foreseeable risk of, say, a toxic gas buildup.
Okay, so no permit needed in that case.
Right. But, and this is super important, even with non-permit required spaces, you still need to do a risk assessment.
You don't just assume it's safe because it doesn't need a permit.
Exactly. There could still be other hazards present, you know, physical hazards, things like that.
Right, because safety is always the top priority.
Always. Now, let's dive into the specific hazards we might encounter in these spaces. The ebook breaks them down into two categories, physical and atmospheric hazards.
Let's start with the physical ones. What are some examples of those?
Well, engulfment is a big one, as we discussed earlier with the grain silos. It's a serious hazard, especially with loose materials or liquids.
Yeah, getting trapped like that sounds terrifying.
It can be incredibly quick and incredibly dangerous. Then you've got structural hazards, which relate to the actual physical integrity of the space itself.
So like unstable walls or ceilings.
Exactly. Think about tunnels in construction where there's a risk of collapses. It's also about things like narrow entry and exit points that could make escape difficult in an emergency. And then there are more general hazards like slippery surfaces or sharp edges.
It's like you need to be aware of your surroundings from every angle.
Absolutely. You need to identify these risks and take steps to mitigate them.
So what can be done to make these spaces safer from physical hazards?
Well, sometimes it's about taking proactive measures, like reinforcing unstable areas to prevent collapses. And of course, proper PPE is essential. Sturdy footwear, protective clothing, anything to minimize the risk of injury from these physical hazards.
Right, so you're not just relying on luck. You're taking concrete steps to protect yourself. Now let's talk about atmospheric hazards, which honestly sound even more insidious.
Yeah, they can be tricky because they're often invisible. You can't see them. Sometimes you can't even smell them, but they can be deadly.
What are the main types of atmospheric hazards we need to be aware of?
The two big ones are oxygen deficiency and the presence of toxic gases.
Okay, let's break those down. What exactly is oxygen deficiency and how does it happen?
Oxygen deficiency basically means the oxygen level in the air drops below the normal, which is about 20.9%.
And how does that happen in a confined space?
It can happen in a few ways. Mm. Another gas could displace the oxygen, like in a sewer where methane might build up.
Right, so the oxygen gets pushed out.
Or chemical reactions happening inside the space could consume the oxygen, leaving less for you to breathe.
Okay, so the oxygen is literally being used up.
And then there's just poor ventilation. If there's no fresh air coming in, the oxygen level can drop over time.
And what are the effects of breathing air with low oxygen?
It can range from mild effects like dizziness, headaches, poor judgment to, you know, much more serious consequences.
Like what?
Unconsciousness, even death. If the oxygen level gets low enough, it can happen really fast, especially in a confined space where the air is limited.
That's scary. Are there any warning signs to look out for? Anything that might tip you off that the oxygen is low?
Feeling lightheaded or dizzy is a big one. Shortness of breath, even if you haven't been exerting yourself, is another.
So you're feeling it in your body.
Exactly. If you start experiencing those symptoms, you need to get fresh air immediately, either by ventilating the space or getting out of there.
Okay, that makes sense. Now let's talk about toxic gases. What are some of the most common ones we might encounter in confined spaces?
The ebook focuses on carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, and methane, which are pretty common and pretty dangerous.
Let's start with carbon monoxide. What's so dangerous about that one?
Carbon monoxide, or CO, is especially dangerous because it's completely colorless and odorless. You can't see it, you can't smell it, but it can be deadly even in low concentrations.
So you might not even know you're breathing it in.
Exactly. It basically binds to your red blood cells, preventing oxygen from getting to your organs and tissues.
Wow, so it's basically suffocating you from the inside out.
In a way, yes. Even low levels can cause headaches, dizziness, and nausea. Higher levels lead to confusion, unconsciousness, and eventually death.
That's terrifying. And then there's hydrogen sulfide.
Hydrogen sulfide, or H2S, has a very distinctive rotten egg smell.
Yeah, that's hard to miss.
At low concentrations, that smell can actually be a good warning sign. But here's the scary part. At high concentrations, it actually paralyzes your sense of smell.
So you might not smell anything, even if you're in serious danger.
Right. You could be breathing in deadly amounts and not even know it. It affects your respiratory system, can lead to rapid unconsciousness and death.
Okay, so carbon monoxide is silent and deadly, and hydrogen sulfide can trick you by knocking out your sense of smell. What about methane?
Methane, or CH4, is the main component of natural gas. While it's not inherently toxic in the same way as CO or H2S, it can displace oxygen, which, as we discussed, can lead to asphyxiation.
Right, so even if it's not poisonous itself, it can still create a dangerous situation.
And it's highly flammable. If there's a spark or an ignition source, it can create an explosion hazard, especially in a confined space.
Okay, so we've got a whole cocktail of potential invisible threats. How do you even know what's in the air you're breathing?
That's where atmospheric testing comes in. The ebook really stresses the importance of using gas detectors and monitors.
What are those exactly?
Portable gas detectors are small devices that workers carry with them. They can detect specific gases like CO or H2S and give you real-time readings.
So you can see exactly what you're dealing with.
Right. And then there are fixed monitors, which are permanently installed in some spaces.
So they're constantly monitoring the air quality.
Exactly. They'll sound an alarm if dangerous levels of any gas are detected.
Okay, so that's how you know what's in the air. But how do you actually manage those risks? You know, make sure you're not just walking into a dangerous situation blindly.
Well, that's where risk assessment and management come in. The guide lays out a very systematic approach to this.
And what's the first step in that process?
The first step is to identify the potential hazards. You need to take a good look at the space, the work that needs to be done, and consider all the things that could go wrong.
And how do you actually go about identifying those hazards?
The guide suggests a few methods. You can do a physical inspection of the space, talk to workers who have experience in that area, review any past incident reports, and use checklists specifically designed for confined spaces.
It's about gathering as much information as possible.
Exactly. You want to get a complete picture of the potential risks, not just the obvious ones.
And then once you've identified the hazards, what's next?
Then you need to assess the level of risk they pose. You consider how likely they are to occur and how severe the consequences would be.
So you're not just listing hazards, you're figuring out which ones are the most serious.
Right. The ebook talks about different methods for doing this, like job safety analysis or JSA, which breaks down a job into its individual steps and analyzes the risks of each one.
Okay, so you're really getting granular with it.
And there's a more comprehensive method called HAZOP, Hazard and Operability Study, which is more of a team-based approach, where you systematically look at potential deviations from normal operating conditions.
Sounds very thorough.
It is. It's all about identifying potential problems before they turn into actual incidents.
So you've identified the hazards, you've assessed the risk. What's the final step in this process?
The final step is to actually manage those risks, and that's where the hierarchy of controls comes in.
And what's that exactly?
It's basically a ranked list of ways to control hazards, starting with the most effective method and working down.
Okay, so give us an example.
The most effective method is elimination. Can you remove the hazard entirely so no one's even exposed to it? If not, then you move down to substitution. Can you replace something hazardous with something less hazardous? Then there are engineering controls, which are physical changes to the space or equipment.
So things like installing ventilation systems or safety guards.
Exactly. After that, you have administrative controls, which are policies, procedures, and training programs.
So that's about changing the way people work, rather than the environment itself.
Right. And finally, at the bottom of the list, you have PPE, personal protective equipment, which is the last line of defense.
So that's when you can't eliminate the hazard or control it in any other way.
Right. It's about protecting the worker directly.
Okay, that makes sense. But it's not just about putting controls in place and calling it a day, right? You need to make sure those controls are actually working.
Absolutely. Monitoring and reviewing your controls is crucial. You need to regularly inspect equipment, audit procedures, make sure everything's functioning as it should.
So it's an ongoing process, not a one-time fix.
Exactly. Safety requires constant vigilance and adjustments as needed.
And that brings us back to the permit system we discussed earlier, which seems like a key component of those administrative controls.
It is. The permit system is designed to ensure that all necessary precautions are in place before, during, and after entry into a confined space.
So it's a way of formalizing the safety process.
Exactly. It's about creating a system of accountability and ensuring that no steps are missed.
So what are the essential components of this permit? What information needs to be documented?
The permit needs to clearly identify the specific confined space, its location, and any relevant details about its structure or access points.
So it's like a fingerprint for that specific space.
You also need to state the purpose of the entry, whether it's for maintenance, inspection, repair, whatever the reason is. And the duration of the entry needs to be specified, the start and end times. This helps to limit the amount of time workers are exposed to potential hazards.
Okay, so it's about setting clear boundaries.
The permit also lists all the identified hazards specific to that space, whether it's toxic gases, oxygen deficiency, structural risks, and so on.
So you're not just saying, hey, there might be hazards in there. You're being very specific.
And for each hazard, the permit needs to outline the control measures that will be in place to mitigate that specific risk. This could include things like ventilation requirements, the type of PPE that must be worn, procedures for isolating energy sources, that sort of thing.
So you're laying out a specific plan for how to deal with each potential problem.
Right. And it needs to be very clear and easy to follow.
And finally, there's the emergency rescue plan, which hopefully you'll never need to use.
Right. But you always need to be prepared. The rescue plan outlines the specific procedures to follow in case of an emergency, the equipment that'll be used, and the roles and responsibilities of everyone involved.
So you're not just saying, call 911 and hoping for the best. You're thinking through the specifics of what needs to happen to get someone out safely.
Exactly. It's about planning for the worst case scenario.
Okay, so we've got this very detailed permit that outlines all the potential hazards and the safety measures. Who's in charge of making sure this is all done properly?
The ebook outlines a clear process for issuing and canceling these permits with defined roles for different personnel.
So walk us through that process.
The process starts with that thorough hazard assessment we discussed earlier. The findings are documented and the planned control measures are laid out. Then this is all reviewed and approved by a competent person, often a safety supervisor, or a designated confined space entry coordinator.
So there's a level of oversight, someone who's making sure everything is done by the book.
Right. And only after all those necessary controls are in place can the permit be officially issued. The person who oversees all of this is typically called the entry supervisor. They're responsible for the whole process, from assessment to issuing the permit.
So they're the gatekeepers.
And then you've got the authorized entrants, the workers who are actually going into the space.
And they need to know all the safety procedures,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. They're responsible for following the plan and using all the specified control measures and PPE correctly. And then there are the attendants who stay outside the space and monitor the entrance.
So they're the eyes and ears on the outside, making sure everything's going okay.
Exactly. And they're the ones who initiate the emergency rescue plan if something goes wrong.
It's a team effort with everyone playing a crucial role. And what happens when the work is finished?
Well, once the work is done and the space is verified as safe, the permit needs to be canceled. This usually involves a final inspection and often some post-entry testing to make sure conditions are back to normal.
So you're not just assuming it's safe, you're confirming it.
Right. And the guide suggests documenting the closure of the permit, noting anything that was observed during the entry, which can help improve future entries.
It's about learning from every experience. Now, let's talk about that last line of defense.
Yeah.
PPE, personal protective equipment.
PPE is crucial for protecting workers when other control measures can't completely eliminate the risk. And the ebook goes into detail about the specific types of PPE that might be needed for confined space work.
Okay, so what are we talking about here?
Well, respiratory protection is essential in any atmosphere where there might be harmful gases, vapors, or low oxygen levels. This could range from simple filtering face pieces to more complex systems like air purifying respirators or even self-contained breathing apparatus or SCBA, depending on the hazards present.
So the type of respiratory protection depends on the specific risks.
Exactly. Then you've got head, eye, and face protection, which includes things like hard hats, safety glasses, and face shields. This is for protection against falling objects, splashes of liquids, or anything flying around in the air.
You need to protect those vulnerable areas. What about protecting the rest of the body?
Body protection is also important. Coveralls, chemical-resistant suits, these can protect the skin and clothing from contact with hazardous substances or extreme temperatures.
So it's about creating a barrier between the worker and the hazards.
Exactly. And of course, there's hand and foot protection. Durable gloves and sturdy safety boots are essential, especially if you're dealing with sharp objects, chemicals, or heavy materials.
Right. You need to protect your hands and feet. They're your tools in many cases.
And finally, in spaces with loud noise from machinery, you need hearing protection like earplugs or earmuffs.
Okay, so we've got a wide range of PPE from head to toe. But how do you know which type is right for the job?
The selection of PPE should always be based on the specific hazards identified in the risk assessment.
So you're tailoring the protection to the risks.
Exactly. If you know there's a risk of exposure to a certain gas, you choose a respirator with the right filter for that specific gas. If there's a risk of chemical splashes, you need a suit made of a material that's resistant to those chemicals.
It's about being specific, not just throwing on any old gear.
And it's not enough to just have the right equipment. You need to know how to use it properly. That's where training comes in, making sure everyone knows how to put on, take off, adjust, and maintain their PPE.
Because even the best equipment won't protect you if it's not used correctly.
Exactly. And regular inspection of PPE is crucial too. You need to check for any damage or wear and tear before each use.
So you're not just assuming your PPE is good to go, you're actively checking it.
And cleaning and maintenance are important as well, following the manufacturer's instructions.
Okay, so the takeaway here is that PPE is essential, but it's only effective if it's the right type for the hazards, used correctly and well maintained.
Exactly. It's just one piece of the puzzle when it comes to confined space safety.
Now, we talked a lot about atmospheric hazards, and that brings us to the critical importance of atmospheric testing and monitoring.
It's absolutely vital. I mean, how else can you know what's in the air you're breathing? Some hazards are invisible, and even those with a smell can become undetectable at dangerous levels.
Right, like that hydrogen sulfide we talked about, knocking out your sense of smell.
Exactly. Without proper testing, you're essentially walking into a potential hazard zone blindfolded.
So you're risking serious health problems or even death.
And it's not just about testing once at the beginning. Continuous monitoring is often necessary, especially if conditions inside the space can change.
So you're constantly checking the air quality, making sure it's safe to breathe.
The guide really hammers this point home, and it's for a good reason. They even cite a tragic case from a few years ago where two workers died in a manhole because of a buildup of toxic and flammable gases.
Okay, so atmospheric testing is non-negotiable. What kind of equipment is used for this?
Well, there are gas detectors, which can detect specific gases like carbon monoxide or hydrogen sulfide. And then there are multi-gas monitors, which can detect multiple gases simultaneously.
So the multi-gas monitors are like an all-in-one solution.
Right. They often have alarms that sound if dangerous levels are detected. Some even have data logging so you can track the readings over time.
And how do you actually go about testing the atmosphere? Where do you test and how often?
The ebook recommends testing at various levels within the space, not just at the entrance. This is because some gases are heavier than air and might be concentrated at the bottom, while others are lighter and might be near the top.
So you're getting a full picture of the air quality.
And depending on the hazards, continuous monitoring during the work might be necessary. This usually involves workers carrying portable monitors with them as they work.
Okay, so you're testing before entry, and then you might continue to monitor throughout the job.
And all the readings need to be documented, the time, date, location, everything, so you have a record of the conditions.
Okay, so it's a very systematic and thorough process.
It has to be. It's about protecting lives.
Now, even with all these precautions, sometimes things do go wrong.
Yeah.
So let's talk about emergency procedures and rescue plans, which are absolutely crucial in these situations.
Absolutely. Because conditions in a confined space can change rapidly, and you're often dealing with hidden hazards, having a well-thought-out emergency plan can be a literal lifesaver.
And what does a good emergency plan look like?
Well, it starts with a thorough risk assessment where you identify all the potential emergency scenarios, you know, things like a gas leak, a sudden drop in oxygen, a collapse, that kind of thing.
So you're thinking through the worst-case scenarios.
Right. And for each scenario, you develop a clear step-by-step procedure for what to do. It needs to be detailed and easy to follow, even under pressure.
Because in a real emergency, people might panic and not think clearly.
Exactly. You want everyone to know exactly what to do without having to think about it too much.
Okay, so you've got the procedures in place, but that's not enough. Right. You need the right equipment, too.
Absolutely. All the necessary rescue equipment needs to be readily available at the work site. We're talking things like harnesses, lifelines, retrieval systems, ventilation equipment, first aid supplies, and, of course, communication devices to coordinate the rescue.
So it's about having the right tools and making sure they're in good working order.
And that everyone knows how to use them. That's where regular drills and training come in. The ebook stresses the importance of simulating different emergency scenarios.
So you're not just reading the plan, you're actually practicing what to do.
Right. Classroom training is important, but it's those hands-on drills that really prepare people for a real emergency.
And what about the rescue equipment itself? What kind of specialized gear is typically used?
Oh, it can vary depending on the specific space, but some common items include harnesses and lifelines, so rescuers can safely enter and retrieve someone.
Okay, those make sense.
What else? Rescue baskets or stretchers can be used to safely transport an injured person out of the space.
I've seen those used in other rescue situations.
And then, depending on the access points, you might need tripods or davit systems. These are basically frameworks that can be set up over the entrance to provide a secure anchor point for ropes and lifting equipment.
So it's about having the right equipment to safely get someone out of the space, no matter what the situation.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that rescue operations often require specialized training and skills. It's not something you just improvise on the spot.
Right. You need to know what you're doing. So who are the people typically involved in a confined space rescue?
Well, there's the incident commander who's in charge of the whole operation. They coordinate everything, make decisions, and make sure everyone's following the plan.
So they're the leader, the one calling the shots.
Right. Then you have the rescue technicians, who are the ones who actually go into the space to perform the rescue. They have specialized training and experience in using the equipment and techniques for safe retrieval.
So they're the highly trained specialists.
And then there's support personnel who assist with things like logistics, medical aid, communications, that kind of thing. They play a crucial role in making sure the rescue operation runs smoothly.
So it's a team effort, everyone working together.
And communication is key. Everyone needs to be on the same page, know what's happening, and be able to communicate clearly and effectively.
So what's the takeaway here when it comes to rescue operations?
The takeaway is that you need to have a plan, the right equipment, trained personnel, and clear communication.
Okay, and that brings us back to training, which has been a recurring theme throughout this whole discussion.
It really is the foundation of everything we've talked about. The ebook highlights that proper training is absolutely essential for anyone who works in or around confined spaces.
And what kind of training are we talking about here?
There are mandatory training programs, often required by OSHA or other regulatory bodies. These typically cover things like hazard recognition, PPE use, emergency procedures, the basics.
So it's about establishing a baseline level of knowledge and skills.
And then there are more specialized training programs for people who have specific roles, like those who perform rescue operations, atmospheric monitoring, or risk assessments.
So the more responsibility you have, the more specialized your training needs to be.
Right, and it's not just a one-time thing. Refresher courses are crucial to keep those skills and knowledge up to date.
So it's a continuous process.
Exactly. And the guide stresses that training should go beyond just the theory. Workers need to develop actual competence, meaning they can apply their knowledge in real-world situations.
So it's about being able to do the job safely and effectively, not just passing a test.
Right. And it's not just about initial training. It's about continuous learning, staying up to date on new hazards, new technologies, new best practices. The field of safety is always evolving.
And that means staying informed, attending workshops, reading industry publications, really taking ownership of your own safety knowledge.
Absolutely. It's about being proactive, not just reactive.
Okay, so training is crucial. We've established that. Now let's talk about communication, which is another essential element of safety, especially in these complex environments.
The ebook makes it clear that effective communication can prevent accidents and save lives. Poor communication, on the other hand, can lead to confusion, delays, and ultimately tragedy.
So what does good communication look like in a confined space setting?
It's about making sure everyone is on the same page, that everyone knows the hazards, the procedures, their roles, and responsibilities.
So there's no room for ambiguity or assumptions.
Right. It's also about being able to share information quickly and accurately, especially in an emergency.
And what kind of methods are used to communicate in these situations?
Well, clear verbal communication is always important, especially for things like pre-entry briefings and instructions.
So face-to-face conversations, making sure everyone understands the plan.
But in a confined space where it might be noisy or difficult to hear, non-verbal communication can be.